It's nice to see him again. He comes from the local HMRC office here in Cambridge. It's called Eastbrook. You can find that at the end of Shaftesbury Avenue. And it's John Burling with us this morning. Morning, John.
Good morning, everybody. How are you?
We're all good, I think.
Good.
Well,
good.
At least, hopefully it will stay that way when we start thinking about all the paperwork, all the online information that we have to file after April the 5th, because the new tax year will be April the 6th. And then there'll be all sorts of little obligations. But you're here to make the story sound a whole lot easier for us today, John.
That's correct. It's something that happened last year, the year before that, the year before that, and it'll happen next year as well.
I bet you can't go far.
You can't get away from
it. I bet you can't tell us how far back it all started, though.
I could, but that would probably take about half an hour to explain why. Why the 6th of... A lot of people say, why the 6th of April? It's a very long, convoluted story about the calendar that used to have 10 months that changed to 10, 12 months. We were behind the rest of Europe. We caught up with Europe. It's a very long story.
Something to do with Gregorian calendars and Roman...
It changed from 10 to 12 months. But here we are, 6th of April approaching, and it's the time of year when employers have to really start thinking about the fact that one tax year is going to end and a new tax year is going to begin in. Now, lots of people that have been doing this for years, payroll bureaus, accountants, agents, are used to doing it, so it's nothing new. But what employers have to remember is that come the 6th of April, there will be new tax codes for their employees. There will be new national insurance rates and new national insurance figures to consider. So really and truthfully, it's a case of not leaving it until the 6th of April, but start thinking about it now, because lots of people use a software to do their payroll. So it means that they should already have been in touch with their software provider to make sure that they've got the new details ready. Now, some people will have already run their month 12 payroll, because they do it during the middle of the month, the 20th, 25th or whatever.
24th always seems to be popular.
It does. Funny enough, my wife works for a bank and hers is the 20th, and that gets it out of the way. But there are lots of companies that will pay on the last working day of the month, which is tomorrow, I do believe. So once that's done, once month 12 is done, or week 52, because lots of people still do a weekly payroll, once they're done, then you have to say, right, that's the final payment in that year. So you have to send to us...
So you put your financial shutters down, if you like, John.
That's
and
right.
You start totalising what you paid people over the year.
Now, most systems will do that anyway. Most systems will actually have a cumulative figure. Lots of pay slips will show pay in the month and pay cumulative to date so far in the year. So lots of systems do this anyway. But once you've done your final payment, your last submission to the HMRC, which is done over the internet via the real-time information system.
And we shouldn't panic people. This is for employers.
This is specifically for employers.
Employers, not employees.
That's correct. Employers every month have to send us a submission of what they've paid to all their employees within that month, how much tax was deducted, how much national insurance was deducted. There could be other things like student loan deductions mixed in there as well. And all that comes to us every month. So this month's submission is no different. It's still a real-time information submission, but there's a little box you have to tick that says, this is my final one of the year. And that then closes that year down. That's the final submission for the tax year that we have from that company, which we then know the first one will be within the new tax year, which starts on the 6th of April. So that's one of the first things employers have to consider.
And they will be using proprietary pieces of software such as, and we'll name more than one so we're not biased towards anyone in particular, in no particular order. They might be using Sage.
I knew you were going to say Sage first.
Or QuickBooks. There's another one
Pegasus,
which I notice is being advertised on the TV at the moment.
Yeah, Pegasus, Hilton Nomis, Iris. There's lots of different ones out there. But there is also a free software that you can download from our website.
The RTI, which stands for?
Real-time information. It's the pay-as-you-earn free software from us. Really and truthfully, it's only suited to companies that have probably up to 9 or so employees. Anything more than that, then you really need to start looking at some sort of payroll software. But these are free, and we update it every year exactly the same. You can save it. exactly the same. You can print off P60s exactly the same. And that was going to be the next thing I was going to talk about, because after you've done your last final submission to us within the tax year, any employee that is still on your payroll, you will have to give them a P60. And a P60 is a summary of the whole tax year.
And that can sometimes, presumably, go out with the month 12, if you're monthly paid, pay slip.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, you can do. And in fact, legislation now says that you don't have to print and give an individual a P60. You have to make it available to them. So you could save it. Send it to somebody in an email.
So an electronic attachment?
An electronic attachment.
A PDF, for instance?
Fine, that's fine. What lots of companies do, because they have their own... If you've got 1,000 employees, you're not going to send out 1,000 emails to individuals. So you make it available on your in-house computer system for people to go in themselves and print off themselves.
They'd have their own personal private,
login. Passwords, logins, things like that. But basically, you're making it available to them. It's like payslips. As long as you make a payslip available to somebody, electronic or paper, that's not a problem at all.
Something I learned from you last time, that you no longer need to issue an employee as an employer a paper payslip anymore.
No. No.
It's not a legal obligation.
No.
It can be done electronically.
It can. And the thing about it is, as a department, and I guess lots of government departments are trying to get away of millions of bits of paper floating around. Now, there's some people out there who will print it off and keep it in a shoebox. And that's fine. There is nothing wrong with that at all. There are other people who will save it, put it on a stick, a disc or backup or whatever, and save it that way. Perfectly acceptable. As long as the employer makes it available to the employee, and as long as the employee has access to it, because if there's ever a query, let's say for some reason someone's paid too much tax, and it can happen for a variety of reasons. If an employee says, I've paid too much tax, I want it back, the first thing we're going to say is, where's your P60? Can we see sight of your P60? Because that is the proof that the employer has given you, so you can apply for your tax refund that way. Also, individuals might at some point later have to do a self-assessment tax return. Now, this follows on a bit later in the year, but one of the pages you have to complete is your pay and tax as an employee. Where do you get that from? Your P60.
That's why it's very important.
It's another reason why it's
say,
made
as,
available.
As you say, HMRC, it's mandatory to say on it, do not destroy.
That's right.
And how long should we keep these for?
Well, now, this is my sad answer. I've got my P60s going back to 1979 when I first started work.
I thought they were going to say something like half a crown on there or a florin or two and six.
It wasn't much more than
money.
It wasn't much more than that. But no, I think you should always keep on your P60s. And the reason why I say that is because, yes, you might want to apply for a tax refund, so you need it. You might want to apply for individual. You might want to receive tax credits, where we pay tax credits to people on middle, low incomes. And your P60 is proof of income. But also, when you reach retirement age, your state retirement pension is based upon your whole working life. So I think keep the P60s your whole working life.
It would prove to the government, I suppose, that you have made national insurance contributions if the Department of Work and Pensions in Newcastle couldn't find any records of NSE payments.
It does sometimes happen. It occasionally happens where people have paid national insurance over a year. For some reason, the P60s come in with the wrong number on it. And that does occasionally happen. Most times we will trace it and we will find it and we will correct it. But if for some reason we can't and we say to somebody, well, actually, in that year, you haven't paid anything. And a person says, ha-ha, here's my P60 to prove I have. It's always useful to keep for those sort of scenarios.
I can see that. I must admit, you say, John, you're keeping them in a shoebox, you know, under your bed or something for X number of decades. Actually, I think the legal requirement is somewhat less. It's only really for 2 or 3 years.
Well, as an employer, you have to keep records by law. As an employee, actually, the law says you don't have to keep records as an employee. It's the employer who has to keep the information. But I still think as an employee, I'm going to keep on to things. And it's not just a P60. Let's say, for example, individuals have benefits in kind, which can range from things like company cars to private health care to beneficial loans. All that information has to be given by the employer to the employee. And that form is called a P11D. And that happens again every tax year. Employers have to give it by law. They have to keep the information by law. If I was an employee, I'd be holding on to those forms as well, in case there's ever any query about the tax that was due, the tax that was paid, how it was calculated.
If you had hotel bills, to make sure that actually they were not benefits in kind, so they were not taxable, or having applied to the NIC class 2A, is it something?
Class 1A.
There you see. Make sure that, you know, you've received the correct amount of reimbursement for stays away, because you've been travelling for a company, been working away, had a hotel stay, you had a train fare, say, to get from your office to that place of work.
Exactly, correct.
Of course, get the money back. But no more than.
Yeah, and this is where the employer's records are so important, because if an individual, as you say, does a train journey to London, comes back, might have an overnight stay in a hotel, attend a training course, attend a seminar, come back, and if they produce the hotel receipt, the train receipt, the seminar receipt, and the company reimburse exactly to the exact penny, because they've got the receipts as proof, then there is no tax obligation.
The tax man doesn't think of it as a benefit.
No, it's not. Just reimbursing a cost which was wholly and exclusively incurred. But again, that's where the employer has to keep the records, because the employer is giving this person, let's say, £300, and we'd say, well, why are you giving them £300? They say, because I've got this receipt, that receipt, and that receipt. And that's absolutely fine. And if people keep these records, and if I was an employee, and I do this myself, I actually make a copy of that receipt for my own records, because I'm now giving it to my employer. I haven't got anything anymore. So I keep a copy for my own records, just to avoid any query, any problem in the future.
And the employees sometimes will have to send in their expenses monthly, and the problem with as you say, you're losing the receipts. And why are the receipts? Of course, because the employer can also claim back some VAT elements of things.
Oh, now you're getting way above my head with VAT.
Not my department, moving you on.
VAT is one of those things where it's a constant thing, because it's happening all the time. There are certain things, like what we're talking about today, which only happen at the end of the tax year. Yes, employers have to do payroll every week, every month. They might be in communication with us about different things. But VAT is one of those constant things, whereas the employer's end of year action, once a year, get it out of the way, and we look forward to next year.
It's the big sign of underlining, isn't it, of the year, drawing it to a close.
Yeah.
In the paperwork.
Sometimes things, though, don't always go correct, because let's say, for example, someone left halfway through a year, you give a P45, and then for some reason you realise, we owe them some holiday pay, we owe them some backdated overtime, we owe them or something. You've got to pay them, but yet you've already given them a P45 and they've left. So things don't always go 100% smoothly, but the tax system has been devised to take account of any of these slight anomalies which might happen.
But sometimes the public criticise the government, or at least HMRC, by saying it's not really a system. John, and you're here to disagree or agree. I don't know what the official line would be, that if you have more than one job, sometimes we can have two part-time jobs and a main job. You know, we have to work hard. Sometimes we want to buy a property in Cambridge, and heck, you know, you need the money. So sometimes the system doesn't really work very flexibly for people that might have, say, more than one employee?
It's getting better, and real-time information is an improvement on that, because it used to be if you started a new job but still had your old job going, we wouldn't sometimes get told until the end of the year. And then we'd be looking at backtracking tax codes, backtracking tax allowances. But with real-time information, because we get told right at the outset a person started, how much they're earning, we can adjust the tax codes almost immediately. And if people do have, let's say they have two jobs, let's say they've also got a pension, let's say they also rent a house out, so you've got four different sources of income coming in, I don't think there's any tax system in the world that could almost deal with that immediately in real time. So that's where we would probably put someone onto self-assessment, because we would say, I'll tell you what, at the end of the year, do a tax form where you put your pay-as-you-earn income, you put your pension income, you put your rental income,
dividends,
all on one
interest,
form.
Interest, everything.
Dividends, yeah. Interest, all goes on one form. We've got all the information then in one place. We can do a tax calculation based upon the whole figure. But that will be reliant on the quickness of how a person gets the tax form into us. The quicker the tax form comes in, quicker we can work everything all out.
And if
but
it's
self-assessment
a paper form,
is self-assessment is left for another subject.
Yes, because that comes up. Not we can all breathe easy for a while, John, before that happens. And of course, the paper ones go in, as we know, at the end of October. But we get extra leeway if we do it electronically, which I now know over 90% of people do.
They do. But as I say, that's looking later in the year. But actually, getting all your P60s, getting your P11Ds, all things like that, is, if you like, getting it ready for self-assessment. I don't, again, there are only one third of the country approximately that does self-assessment, because there's lots of people who are in a pay-as-you-earn job, get a monthly salary, that's it. There's no need for them to be in self-assessment.
Because it's very regular. It's as regular as a pendulum, swinging, if you like, backwards and forwards. Lots of consistency, no ups and downs, or, shall we say, slightly more unusual incomes? You're not interested, are you?
Employer does it. The tax code does change every year, and that's one of the things that employers need to worry about now. But, you know, they've got no benefits in kind, no company in cars. Self-assessment doesn't apply to them. Real-time information does the job perfectly.
It's nice to know that two-thirds of us exist in our lives that way, isn't it?
Without self-assessment.
It's the other one-third that get the headache once
a year. Well, it's not so much a headache now, because self-assessment online is brilliant, because you put all the information in and it does the calculation for you. As long as you've got the correct information, as long as all your records, if you're a company director, if you're a sole trader, if you own a house, if you rent property, as long as you've got all your information correct and up to date, self-assessment online is a lot easier. It's like employers. Provided you've got all the correct information, doing stuff online, doing real-time information, you can even do P11Ds online now. It's so much easier.
And that is going to change next year. The P11D, the expenses and benefits, there's some new rules, isn't there, from the taxman. This might be, though, for another day, John, while you draw your
breath. Just briefly mention it. It's called payroll and benefits, and it's only being trialled at the moment. Some companies can do it, some companies don't have to do it. But rather than pay benefits separately, it can be put in the payroll, tax and national insurance accounted for, done and dusted. You don't have to worry about P11Ds at the end of the year. But that can't cover all benefits and expenses. It's only a certain few.
That's all we have time for, John. There's a mine of information from yourself, and you've got loads more to tell us.
I could be here all day.
That means you should come back and tell us more.
I will do.
Time. Interesting. Who said the tax man couldn't be interesting? That was very interesting, John. Thank you very much.
No problem. All the best to everybody.
And all the best to you. And we'll see you in the new tax year.
Certainly will.
I have my lovely, lovely guest, Dr. Deborah Pardo, who's taking photos. Very good. We can all do this now, can't we? So, Deborah, this is my guest here today, Dr. Deborah Pardo. I'm going to give you a quote, actually, because Sheryl Sandberg said, Chief Operating Officer, she said, we need women at all levels, including the top, to change the dynamics, reshape the conversation, to make sure women's voices are heard and heeded, not overlooked and ignored. So that was a really interesting quote that was put up on the Homeward Bound Project website, which I thought was fantastic. Dr. Deborah Pardo, a postdoctoral researcher based at the British Antarctic Survey in Madingley Road, has been selected along with two other UK women scientists. They are Dr. Rayan Miller and Dr. Andrea Fitchett, to join an all-female team of scientists for a three-week trip to the Antarctic Peninsula as part of a major global research. Now, the project name is Homeward Bound. I think it's called Homeward Bound 16. Is that right, Deborah?
Yes.
Yes. Well, welcome. Lovely to have you here. It's so, so nice. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the expedition, first of all?
Yes. So thanks for having me today. It's really a pleasure for me as well. So it's much more than an expedition, really. It's going to last the whole year. That's why it's Homeward Bound 16. And it's going to last also for 10 years. That's why it's Homeward Bound 16. It's a project starting from Australia, from a leadership expert, Fabian Dattner, and a postdoctoral researcher as me, who just became a mum this month, and she's working in Antarctic research. And I got together with the fact that women in science are really underrepresented in the highest responsibility. So they wanted to do something about this. And so they felt that one of the main things they could do is to create a network of 1,000 women scientists over 10 years. And I've just been selected for the first year. So the whole point is to put us together with 78 women selected for the first round. We are already working on selected projects together. There are many different projects. I'll come back to it later. But it's really to have us start getting connected and start producing outputs in education, in outreach, in plenty of domains. And also, we are representing as many countries as possible. These sessions, I think we are 11 countries. So we are just three in the UK and I'm the only French. So it's quite an honor, really.
That's fantastic. And the question I wanted to ask, and obviously I'm just asking because I'm a little bit naive to Antarctica. Why Antarctica? Why would that be the most? Was that the first choice for this homeward bound? I suppose.
Yeah. So why Antarctica? Because first of all, it's a very remote place, but the effect of climate change are particularly striking there. It's 75% of our drinking water over there, and it's melting at a rate it's never been before in the past. We can see that based on ice cores that have been digged out from Antarctica. And so we are all the 78 women are working on different aspects of climate research. So we're going to have a science training over there linked with what is particularly observable in Antarctica. The second point is that we want to make noise. Because we're a crew, an all-woman crew going to Antarctica, the media is really interested, and the people as well, they want to know more about it. And Antarctica is really a mystical place, and it's been explored by adventurers in the past, and a lot of tourists want to go also now. So it's really a strong thing for us, and it's really, passionate.
Yes.
And the third point why we're going to Antarctica is that we're building a strong team spirit, and this is going to be an incredible experience for all of us. And
so tell us about the expedition. Are you living in what sort of environments are you living in?
We're going to be on a ship. It's called the Ushuaia, and it's leaving from Ushuaia in December for 3 weeks. We're going to travel the Drake Passage and go down to Antarctica and go around different sites every day. We will take a zodiac and go visit scientific bases.
What's a zodiac?
A boat. A small boat.
Okay, yeah.
Sorry.
You're really getting into the technical terms already. Yeah, fantastic.
And visit scientific bases, meet researchers there, also go to historical points, for instance, on Elephant Island, where Shackleton was stranded with his crew.
That's right. I did read about that on the website, that you're going to explore that part.
Hopefully. And we're going to see penguin colonies that are declining and learn about that. And that's also where I can try to step in with my research and give some information that I know, because I'm working on albatross demography and how their populations are declining with climate change and overfishing. Yeah.
So, Deborah, you do a lot of talks to schools as well. I know we haven't touched on this, but it is fantastic. So can you just tell me, how will Homeward Bound achieve its goals? I know that's a big question and you can't answer it all today, but a little part of it will be
so
as good.
The two main goals of Homeward Bound are to help women achieve higher leadership responsibilities and to show that there's a strong connection between empowerment of women and action against climate change at the scale of the planet. So the first goal is going to be tackled by Homeward Bound by giving us, during the expedition, but also before, because we're starting actually this week, the best available leadership, strategy and innovation training. So the core team in Australia is working hard to gather specialists from around the world and to also have them on board with us to give us the best training possible at the moment.
And the training will be now up until the expedition, is that
yes.
right? Is that a constant? Is that a weekly or a monthly?
I don't really know. No. I know that this week we have the first 2 hours strategy webinar with the specialist. Yep.
Of course, webinar. That makes such a lot of sense, doesn't
webinar,
it?
Webinar, because we're 78, we're spread out in the whole world with different time zones, and it's quite complex.
I think that's incredible, don't you, that you can get 78 women from all over the world to be trained on one particular project by webinar. I mean, years and years ago, that would have been an impossible task, wouldn't it?
It's the magic of internet. We're already
exactly.
in contact every day with different groups of women from the crew, and we kind of know each other already before going on the trip. It's really exciting.
Fantastic. So I know we've asked this, but we've touched on why women, because I mean, one of your particular interesting sentences here, which I read, I thought that was fantastic, was women are more affected by climate change and prone to change in both developing and developed countries. Now, for me, that's really interesting, because we all think that we're in developed countries, we can manage the social aspect, we can do it all, but actually it affects both of us, doesn't it?
Yes, so I've made a bit of research on this, and it's quite striking, because we know that women in developing countries are responsible for gathering resources, taking care of their family, gathering water, firewood, and also taking care of the community behind all this. So when there's a catastrophic climatic event, it's the women that are more affected. Also because when food starts lacking, they are sometimes, because of cultural things, they have to eat after the men, or they have to go and gather water much further. And also because of the pregnancy and breastfeeding, they have higher nutritional demands and they're more fragile, really. So they're more influenced by climate change. But when there are climatic problems, and it's been seen in the US after the Katrina hurricane, violence against women, physical and sexual, are more common. And
what, during a catastrophic
after
moment?
After a catastrophe, because the resources are more scarce, people are more tense, and they start beating women up.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very common.
So if you bring that back into your expedition, you are trying to work together to try and overcome this by...
So because of this particular relationship between women and climate, because it's also been shown by studies in developed countries, in our countries, that women are more aware of climate change and they're more prone to change. So if we manage to have more women in leadership, in particular in science and environmental policy, we can potentially have a much different vision than what has been done so far, because it's mostly men out there, and potentially a stronger effect, because we need change now.
Yes, yeah. I couldn't agree more, and I'm really absolutely in awe of what you're doing.
Thank you.
If we go on to how will Homeward Bound Expedition communicate? This is the most important thing, isn't it? Because it's great doing what you're going to do, but you've got to get this message across, haven't you? So are you going to do a bit of the astronaut peak during the... Are you going to communicate from the base that you're going to be at? From the boat, rather, sort of, not the bait.
Yes.
the base. Will you be communicating...
We don't know that because the internet stuff is not sorted out on the
right.
boat. But there's a lot of communication happening already. We have an official press team from the Homeward Bound project, and they are doing official press releases. And it's been shown that we reached 40 million people in the first press releases that we've done.
That's fantastic.
Apart from that, each of the 78 women has to fundraise to be part of it. And this is really empowering in itself, because it forces us to network, to communicate a lot around us being part of the project in the 11 countries we are part of. And this is making a lot of noise around the project. Also, I was telling you before, there is an education part of the project, and we're talking, a lot of us are involved in talking to schools. I'm doing it both in Canada, in France, and in the UK. Next week, or maybe the week after, I'm going to Hills Road Sixth Form to talk with the students, and I'm happy to talk to other schools if they want. We are doing an Adopt a Scientist program, so this is also good for the kids to integrate science careers and maybe change the future, really.
So, Deborah...
And also, I forgot to say something, sorry.
Do.
Of course, there's a TV documentary following us on board to make really a film about the how women can have a different relationship with the environment and how they can be maybe our best solution to the future of the planet. This is an Australian national crew, and the TV documentary will be in English, spread around the world.
And that's post or pre the event?
It's all post, pre, during, and post event.
Right. So, I was just thinking, and I'm not going to think online on air here, but if during the expedition that you have, if there was a chance you could come and or someone could talk online to Radio Cambridge 105, that would be fantastic, wouldn't it?
I would love to. If I can, I'll do it.
That would be nice, wouldn't it? I think Peak achieved quite a bit by his presence and his way he communicated with us through the internet. It's a real first, I think, for us.
Yeah.
And it's in our minds. And I thought that was absolutely amazing. For you guys to be going over is equally as amazing.
We want to
I
make
think.
As much noise as possible, really, to make people realize the importance of those matters.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to remind my station manager, see if we can get you online during your expedition. So the other question I want to ask is environmental policies. Do you see them influencing or changing for the better in which developing countries do you think are really important, key for... So you've got 78 women from probably... Obviously, from developing countries, haven't you?
Mostly developed countries. Mostly
developed, right?
Yes.
So, if you were to catch one area, what areas would
it's
be?
It's a difficult
most...
question. So, my subgroup in the project is to work on the influence of women on environmental policies. We haven't started really yet, but what we've done so far is a correlation between national environmental index showing how good the countries are doing in environmental policy, and a gender difference in how many women they have in parliament in national countries as well. And we've made a correlation with these two measurements, and it's very significant and positive. So the more a country is investing in the environment, the more women it has in politics.
That's very
interesting. So we haven't got further than that yet, but it's interesting to note that the correlation works whatever the GDP. So it works in very developing countries, like Rwanda, for example, is a very good example because it has a lot of women in the boards. And also in Scandinavia as well, it's working really well, as well in Costa Rica, who's a middle GDP country. So I'll come back to you when I know a bit more.
That would be lovely.
There's definitely something to investigate here.
Yes, there is. And it is a fascinating subject. And fascinating subjects are all well and great. But when you actually start to change things, it becomes an even better moment, doesn't it?
That's really part of our training on board. It's leadership, science, strategy and innovation. So we want to come back home with a clear goal for changing things. It's not just going on the training and coming back and that's it.
Yeah.
We really want to change things. And I'm sure over the 10 years, imagine, at the end of the 10 years, so 2027, when all 10 crews will be back, 1,000 women in science will have received this and will be working together in this network. It will definitely change things, I'm sure.
A great admiration. Now, one of the most important things, obviously, the expedition, but we want to get across your crowdfunding, don't we? So can you tell us a little bit about how we can access that?
Yes. So we have built a research crowdfunding page with the two other ladies from the UK, Dr. Andrea Fidget and Dr. Ryan Miller. It's called, it's on the FTSI platform, FUTSCI. So you can have a look online, and if you want to contribute, you'll be part of the adventure with us, and you'll really work towards making a change for women in science and for women in leadership and for the future of our planet, really. And there's also another event I'm doing in Cambridge on the 6th of May later this year with the Alliance Française, the French Alliance. We're organizing an event with a photo show from relationship between women and climate. I'm giving a talk about the relationship between women and climate in the world on the background with a lot of photos from the world. And it's also a crowdfunding event, so you are very welcome if you want to join and discuss with us around a glass of wine.
And where was that again?
The French Alliance.
The French.
On Hills Road.
Ah, brilliant. That is excellent. That's French on Hills Road. That will be a very... And that's an evening event?
Yes, it's an evening event. I can send you the poster.
Fantastic.
We can put it online.
Thank you. Oh, that will be a very good idea. I think we should. Dr. Deborah Pardo,
yes.
Thank you very much indeed. It's
thank
a really
you.
Fascinating subject.
Thank
and
you.
I wish all of you, all 78 of you, the three of you here and the rest, I think it's an incredible, incredible place to
We're
do.
We're really determined.
I bet you are determined and I look forward to hearing more about it. And as I said, maybe later on in December, well, along the way, we can hear from you as well, live maybe, or a little short report that you could write to us and we can read it out.
I'm planning on doing monthly YouTube videos to keep all the people that sponsored me so far up to date and show them how I'm getting prepared and everything. So,
and we will air that on the radio as well.
Yes.
Thank you very
thank
much
you.
Indeed.
Henry Barnes from the charity National Autistic Society. That's because it's World Autism Awareness Day on Saturday, the 2nd of April. It's a nationally observed day across the world, in fact, encouraged by the United Nations and its member states to take measures to raise the awareness about children with autism throughout the world. So good afternoon to Henry. Hello, Henry.
Hi there. Thanks very much for having me on.
How are you this afternoon? Okay.
Yeah, I'm very well. Very busy, but very well.
I was going to say, it must be a very busy time for you just now.
It's pretty busy.
Okay, now, the thing about autism is that I suspect a lot of people, or the majority of people, perhaps don't know a whole lot about it, other than maybe watching that film with Dustin Hoffman a few years ago, Rain Man. And we
sure.
saw some exhibits of some of the symptoms of autism during that movie. Could you sort of just run through some of the things that people would identify with autism?
Yeah, so autism is a spectrum condition, and it affects the way in which a person understands the world around them and understands their place in it. It can affect social imagination and social communication. People with autism can also have difficulties with needing extra processing time or difficulties with sensory processing. For example, someone with autism might have an oversensitivity to light and might need to wear sunglasses to avoid very bright fluorescent lights. But because it's a spectrum condition, it means it affects people in very, very different ways. So all people with autism will share some various traits, but no person's experience of autism will be exactly the same.
So
in fact, there's an old saying that that goes like this, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism.
Really? So that leads me on to another question that I wanted to ask you, which is it easy to spot? And I guess by virtue of what you've just said, it's incredibly difficult to spot, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's also a hidden disability. There are no, you know, necessarily any sort of immediate, you know, it's not a thing. It doesn't have a sort of visual cue, if you like. So it can be very hard to spot. And because it affects someone's communication abilities and processing times, it can be very, very hard to pick up. Yeah.
So how common is it?
So it's estimated that it affects about 1 in 100 people, which means that in the UK, over 700,000 people are on the autism spectrum.
And is it something that always starts in childhood, or can somebody start to change and become autistic in later life?
No, it's a lifelong condition, which means it's from birth, and children with autism become adults with autism. So it's with you forever. People with autism are often able to sort of develop coping strategies and learn behavior to help them, get along in society and at work and in life in general. But yes, no, it's something that's that starts from birth and is with you forever.
Now, you said that it affects different people in different ways, but is there a severity level as well? Can you, are some people more affected than others?
Certainly, yeah, that is true, yeah. I mean, some people might have real problems with sensory processing. So you might have, you know, a hyper, so an oversensitivity to light and sound and touch, but might be much better with social communication. And others might be the exact opposite, but they might very well all be on the autism spectrum. So I think we tend to think of a spectrum as a linear, you know, from severe to mild. But actually, I don't think we should think of autism in that way.
Now, I mentioned about the film with Dustin Hoffman, Rain Man, from a few years ago. One of the it was Dustin Hoffman himself who portrayed the person with autism, and one of the symptoms that he displayed, I think, is related to the Asperger syndrome. Is that right?
You didn't see the film. No, I have seen the film.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
So Asperger syndrome is a form of autism, and people with Asperger syndrome tend to have average or higher than average IQs. And it's there are a number of different things that separate it out from classic autism, but it is an autism spectrum condition. So it's all, do you see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, I do. So they basically exhibit enhanced abilities in terms of their mental capabilities.
Well, no, I mean that is a common misconception, and it's characters like Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man and others that have shown us savantism, which certainly does exist, but it's not a sort of autistic superpower. In fact, many people with autism really, really struggle, you know, in their day-to-day lives and need a bit of extra support from the general public.
So you mentioned that autism basically starts at birth. So I guess one of the key aspects of treating these symptoms is to identify it. And so how good are medical professionals at identifying it early on?
Well, it's a bit of a mixed bag, generally, the way it would work is if a parent was worried about their child or was thought that their child might be on the autism spectrum, they should go to their GP. And from there, a GP will make a referral to more specialist services and then start them down that diagnostic pathway.
Okay, but would there be anything specific that parents would need to look out for that might sort of make them think, oh, this is maybe, you know, I was talking to a lady yesterday with a child who was autistic, and she said, well, he just didn't start to talk as early as some children would.
Delayed speech is sometimes associated with autism, though. Typically, people with Asperger syndrome don't have that delayed speech, so it's a very unique thing. I think the more the public are aware, the more the public understand the condition, the more parents will know, you know, what to look for, and the more people will be able to access their communities.
Okay, now, earlier on I mentioned that this weekend is rather special as far as autism is concerned, both with Saturday being World Autism Awareness Day, and then you have a whole week of autism-focused activities as well. Can you tell us a little bit about what the charity is up to?
Absolutely, yep. So last year we started the initiative, World Autism Awareness Week, and it was actually our biggest, most successful fundraising week ever, I think. It raised over £235,000 in the week, and it was people took part in our night walks, which are again, they're happening again this year, this time in London and Manchester, where we have people who get sponsored, and some dress up in onesies, and walk the streets of London over a specific route to raise money and awareness of autism. We also have a number of pop-up shops, which will be open during the week around the country. So we have seven of them, which are going to generally sell products that have been made by autistic people in our services, as well as artwork as well. We also have our sort of flagship fundraiser, our Onesie Wednesday, where we encourage people to dress up in a onesie and hold a bake sale or any number of fundraising activities.
All right. And is that during the week, this week coming?
Yep, that's this week coming. So the World Autism Awareness Week begins on Saturday, the 2nd of April. But it's a particularly exciting one for us this year because we're actually launching our biggest ever public awareness campaign. It's called Too Much Information, and it's launching tomorrow. And it's going to be really, really exciting.
Well, I wish you luck with certainly tomorrow's launch and the week ahead, as far as that's concerned. If people are sort of suspicious of their children in terms of suspecting that they might have autistic symptoms, what's the best thing they can do?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, more understanding will hopefully help. So I would encourage anyone who wants to find out more about autism or who wants to get involved in Too Much Information to visit our website at autism.org.uk and find out more.
Okay, Henry, thanks ever so much for coming along that on the line and talking to us about that. That's Henry Barnes. He's the Area Project and Participation Officer from the National Autistic Society. And as I say, can I wish you the best of luck for everything in the coming 7 days?
Much. We've got Charlie Pollington, massage therapist in front of me. Good morning, Charlie. Nice to see you. I'm fine, thank you. And you're here to talk about knees today. Do you see a lot of people with knee problems?
Yeah, knees are very common. It's the joint that takes the most stress through the body.
Is it?
Yeah, in terms of just one joint, because although obviously if you're running, first protocol is your foot and ankle, but there's lots of little joints in there, lots of different bits of fascia that kind of, so they're not any one joint is taking all of that load, but go up to the knee and it's one big joint, so it's taking the full amount of the force through the knee and also from the upper body. So
it's quite a complicated joint.
Complicated, it is kind of complicated, yeah. Though it's actually, in some ways, it's kind of simple because it's just a big knuckle joint, but in the way that it works, it's quite complicated because it's kind of controlled from above. So the knee really is mainly controlled from your, what most people think of their hips. It's not their hips, it's their glutes, but it's the gluteal muscles and obviously your quads, which are the front of your leg muscles. There's some definitely coming up from the foot, but they've kind of worked out actually most of the issues sort of from the top down, so top being the glutes.
So you're making it sound like it's almost like the hinge of the body, even though it's...
Kind of it is, yeah. And I think that just, like, even with, obviously you think the hip as well obviously takes a lot of things, but that's a more enclosed joint. The knee, if you think about it, is sort of quite, could move around quite a bit because it's a knuckle joint. And then, of course, it has on top, which is the other thing that causes people a lot of problems, is the kneecap. And the kneecap actually is technically outside of... It's part of the greater knee complex, but it's outside of the knee joint because it's a protective... It's just a little protective bone in the tendon of the quads, of the thigh muscle. Because when you bend your knee opens up so far that there'd be a big gap, so nature's stuck a sort of shield bone in there, which is great. But it has to travel up and down the tendon in a bony groove, and if that isn't on point, then... And it's sort of going east or west a bit, if you like, then it will clip on the bony condyles. And after, you know, you go out running for 5 kilometres, 10 kilometres, or whatever, you come back and go, oh, ow, that hurts. Because it's, you know, if it's not going up nicely up and down that sort of knuckly groove, then it can give you pain.
So what can go wrong then with the knee? You mentioned one thing there.
Well, that's a kind of normal chronic thing, is patellar or femoral pain. That's what that is. And then there are links that if you have that chronically through your life, which often people do because they never get their knee tracking sorted out, they never quite strengthen up the muscles properly. There is some evidence that, or quite a lot of evidence, that later on in life you could end up with osteoarthritis behind there, and that's more common than osteoarthritis of the what they call the tibial femoral joint, which is basically the main knee joint, if you like, the main knuckle. So it's more common to get arthritis on the back of there because you've never quite got the tracking, and it's quite hard correct, and it's quite hard to sort of do if you don't sort of think about it or have someone look at you, really. Other things that can happen to knee, obviously, are more sort of traumatic things, which you do hear about football players with the cruciate ligaments or skiers. Cruciate ligaments, skiing's a great one. Can't get a better thing for giving you cruciate injury than, you know, big long skis and boots that immobilise your ankles. You know, it's just the sheer forces when something goes wrong are pretty bad. And then along with those, or sometimes to the side of those, you have what are called meniscal injuries. And the meniscus is basically the cartilage that's on the knuckles of your thigh bone and your shin bone. You get two for the price of one, often with a cruciate, anterior cruciate injury, because that inserts into one of the menisci. And so when that ruptures badly, that pulls up the meniscus as well. So you get two injuries in the price of one there. Or you just get wear and tear on the meniscus, the cartilage, which is often what people then go in and have a little arthroscopal snip arthritis because your knee's catching or whatever. But that normally will then come back to the more the kneecap patellofemoral thing, that if your knee's not tracking very well, then you can wear your cartilage not in an even way and then get cartilage problems.
And you'd know that you had a problem in your knee through the pain.
You'd normally know through the pain. You, although you don't always have to have pain, but what you can have is if it clicks, for a meniscal, for the cartilage, if it stutters or it just, sometimes it can just feel wrong or just suddenly gives way. I mean, normally you will have had some sort of a painful episode at some point, but not always, because the pain process is so wired into your brain that sometimes your brain just release you even before you've reached pain, you know, just to get you out of danger, if you like. So, but normally you'll know one of those things is kind of going on.
It's when you're walking downhill as well, isn't it? That puts an awful lot of pressure on your knees. That's when suddenly something.
Well, also not only that, it's because but that's a lot with the patellofemoral pain, because your quads, the front knee muscles, will be pulling on the tendon that bone sits in. So if you've got a bit of an issue going on with the back of your kneecap, which is what it is, then when the quads are working hard, which is what they're doing, they're controlling your descent, if you like. So they're pulling hard through there. So they're pulling the back of that bone down onto your bony condyles. And then if you've got an issue, because you're putting more pressure through it, it's gonna come out and be more ow, you know. So that's why you often feel it going down.
So what can you do to avoid it? We'll talk about if you have a knee problem, how you might solve it or make it better. But how would you avoid even getting a knee problem in the first place?
Well, it's to check out the various balances of your muscles and your strength. Most of the time, most people aren't strong enough. Actually, this relates to the shoulder, it relates to a lot of body. We're just too sedentary. We're not strong enough anymore. We just don't do enough of exercise to keep our sort of joint health good. But really what you'd be looking at for the knee is glutes. So what you think of is your hip muscles, those muscles really, making sure that they're strong. And then obviously your quads, and then the back of your legs, your hamstrings as well. So all of those need to be strong.
So all the muscles around it, you need to be doing weights or some form of exercise?
Well, it really depends on how bad it is or what's going on. You need to have someone look at you really, because what you'd do first of all is you'd see whether you've got good control. They call it neuromotor. So that doesn't have to be hard exercise, but it can be literally like if you stand on one leg, one with a slightly bent knee, can you roll your pelvis forward and back? Can you hitch your hip?
I can't stand on one leg, John.
Well, I know, this is the thing. And actually, I would say if you can't stand on one leg, straight away, your control is not good enough. That's straight up. That's your entry level. I often get people standing on one leg and go, oh, I can't. I'm going, well, you know, we've got an issue here that you need to work on. Because then you're more advanced. What you should better do is stand on one leg, roll your pelvis forward and back as front and back, hitch your pelvis up and down, so that's the side to side, and then you should be able to keep your knee straight and then rotate your hips away.
Blimey!
Yeah, it's quite a lot of things. And then you need to, once you've got that, because if you're trying to build strength without getting that control first, then you're sort of going, putting the cart before the horse. So you need to make sure, and it doesn't actually normally take that long. You can just literally do that over a couple of weeks. If someone's teaching you, and then, you know, you can build up to it, because as it says, neuromotor, it's just that you haven't, and maybe pain has altered what you, because pain will alter your movement very quickly. So you just work within your pain-free zone and then gradually build up from there. And it's just sort of getting back into your brain firing those muscles in a certain way. It's kind of like it's forgotten how to move your body in all the ways it can move. So you do a couple of weeks of sort of that, and then you can start to move off into strength and endurance and more power, which is what you ultimately need to then lock everything down.
And presumably, you know, the older you get, the more likely you are to have knee problems, the more wear and tear.
Yes, there is that, but there's just more chance that these things weren't picked up in earlier life, and then there's more chronicity, if you like. Then that comes out, yeah. Or the bad habits that you had in sport never got ironed out, and then again you pick up the pieces later on. Or if you are like a rugby or a football player or whatever, there's just more chance you've had a trauma. I mean, those are contact sports, because obviously we're talking about your body not moving in an optimal way. But obviously, if you're playing a sport like that, you've got the added thing that you've got some huge guy crashing into your knee, or you've gone down a ski slope and you've come off your skis and you've gone all over the place, and so that's a traumatic thing, or a car crash or something like that. Obviously, those things can leave you with residual issues that you'll have to manage.
For a long time, can't they? My brother-in-law, he had a knee injury when he played rugby when he was about 15. Yeah. He's now in his 50s and it's still painful.
Yeah, it can be. But underlying all that, the best thing to do is still to make sure that you're as strong as you can possibly be. So to actually, you know, you'd think it'd be to, you, obviously you'd rest it initially if, when you've just had the injury, but long term, you want to make sure you're as strong as possible. I actually worked on a friend of mine actually the other day, but he's a very good hockey player. He blew his ACL totally in 97 and damaged his meniscus at the same time, but carried on playing at top level because he trained himself up. And then when I was testing his knee, I was thinking, I haven't seen such a solid knee in ages. And yet when we were moving it around, we can tell that the meniscus is shot to bits because it's cracking and popping and graunching. You're like, we're going, whoa, this sounds bad. But underneath it all, because he's kept himself so strong, he's got a, you know, the passive structures maybe all, which are like the cartilage and the ligaments and stuff, maybe all not working very well, but the muscular control is holding it all together. So always try and stay as strong as you can.
And you said before, if you're about to do any exercise, or even if you are doing regular exercise, just to get somebody to look at your gait.
I think it's a good idea, especially for running, because running is such a kind of, it's quite hard on your body. And the thing, I think we said before, is because we all can run, we all just think, and it's cheap, so you don't have to sign up. You just jump up from the desk now and go running off home or whatever. And it's great, it's easy, it's accessible, and it's cheap and all the rest of it. And we can all do it. But most of us do it badly. And because we're actually putting, you know, 3 to 5 times your body weight through the joint system, you want to sort of make sure you're not doing some of the common things that you do where you overstride. What you really want to do is you normally want to shorten your stride length, increase what we call your cadence, which is sort of your strike rate that your feet hit the ground per minute or whatever. And then what that does is often brings your feet underneath your hips. So when they land, they're underneath your hips and your knees are slightly soft, bent. And then the muscles take the strain. And there's not a massive shock wave. And that's a good thing. So you get someone to look at you for that. And then also, like I was saying just now, not to scissor run, which is where you sort of cross your feet over, or even if going towards the midline, you want them to kind of be like a track about 18 inches apart. So even those two things, that's called kinematics, which is basically sort of the movement patterns of how you run. And you can, quite often you'll never know, or you might have something that they call hip drop. So you'll have hip drop and that shows certain muscular weaknesses, normally again around the glutes. So if you're strengthening those up, you should see that disappear. But often these things won't come out. Like if I get someone, I might test them standing and be fine. I might see them walking around, they're fine. But then as you increase load, i.e. as you increase the intensity of what you're doing, like running, then the issues will come out because obviously you're testing the system even more. So yeah. Running tests the system a lot. So
well, I mean, as I was saying to you off air, I had a very painful knee about three years ago and I was doing interval running, so fast and then slow, and then slow on a running machine. And it started about 3 weeks after I started that. And when I went to a physio, she made me stand on one leg and up against the wall and all of that. And she said, yes, you've got one leg slightly shorter, which is disappointing because I need every inch
I
can get.
Well, most of us have got some slight differences, actually.
That was meaning that when I was slowing down, everything was converging on that shorter leg. And so all I needed to do was just slow down in a different way. And everything was fine then.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, basically what you took a tissue to overload is what we say. So, you know, by the interval running. But then you can, you know, if someone knows what they're doing, they can quickly manage you out of that sometimes.
So you might be spending some money up front, but then you're saving yourself.
Oh, yeah, well, you're saving yourself injury. I just think if you want to, say, for instance, run properly and you want to go out and start doing half marathons or even 10Ks or whatever, it's worth investing. So otherwise, you can just quite easily injure yourself because we can all run, but most of us run badly. There are very few people who naturally run, you know, like Mo Farah or whatever. He probably learned how to. He's probably naturally good, but then learned how to run even better. So it's worth it because, you know, then you can just keep running for longer. It's a great exercise if you get it right, you know.
So if you have got problems with your knee, what would be the best way of resolving it? Is it somebody like yourself, a massage therapist or physio?
Yeah, exactly. I would say because often what happens as well, so especially if it's painful. When your body's in pain, the brain of the body is very good at altering how you move to get you out of pain because it's like, no, I don't want the pain. And so you will start to have funky movements, if you like, and not in a good way. you would want to see someone. They would assess you, and then quite often they would tape you up to start off with, you know, for the first few weeks just to help reduce the pain. So, for instance, with the kneecap issue, patellofemoral pain, you can just tape the kneecap across, and you just play with someone. They do like a little bit of a squat, and then you just push their kneecap in different ways. There's 3 different planes of motion, and then you can tape them accordingly, you know. And then you can teach the person how to do that as well, so they can go off and do that before they run. So so then when you're not in pain, then you can get your body, the neuromotor stuff, working properly. Because it, that won't really work if you're in pain, because you just don't want to go into the painful plane of motion, whatever that happens to be, even if that's the good one you want to be going into. So,
and when your knee does hurt and you're trying to fix it temporarily at home, is it ice or a hot water bottle on the knee, or neither?
Well, ice is when you just injured something. So if you've had a traumatic injury, it's definitely ice, because that's just for vasoconstriction to try and bring the inflammation down a bit. But long-term, a bit of inflammation is good. That's what it's there for, is to sort of get all the white blood cells and get the repair processes going. But, yeah, to stop the blood, the bleed, you want ice. And then later on, it would be sort of heat. Or you can sometimes do combinations thereof, you know, heat and ice.
Yes, because the instinct is to go all nice and warm and have a bath.
Yeah, I would say, well, I mean, you could do that sort of a few days down the line, but especially with injuries, ice it up first of all. But there is a school of thought that if you're training and you've got inflammation due to a training load thing, but this is again if you're sort of doing some more high level sport, then that inflammation you want, because it will be increasing your body's ability to deal with the training. But for us regular Joes, and we, you know, you twist your ankle or whatever, get some ice on it straight away.
Ice on it.
Or twist your knee, get some ice on it straight away.
Well, it's lovely to see you again,
yeah, you
Charlie.
Too. Yeah,
how's your little one?
Yeah, very good, thank you. Yeah, kept us awake a lot more last night, so I'm eating my words from last year, so she was asleep.
How old is he now?
She's 18 months, just coming up, yeah.
Oh, right, yeah. So toddling around now.
Toddling around, yeah, lots of that, yeah.
Keeping you busy.
Great, oh, yeah.
It's interesting for you. You can see how...
I can see how it works, yeah.
Moving in the natural state before you develop all those bad habits.
Though I keep looking and thinking, God, is that knee kicking out there? And then you think, well, it's way too young to be sort of worrying about that. But, you know, it is great to see, yeah.
Oh, well, lovely to see you again.
You
and if you want to learn more about your work, it's targetmassage.co.uk.
That's right, yes. And I'm at the Coach House League and Viney Road, down the road, just off Mill Road as well.
Lovely. Thank you,
Brilliant.
Charlie.
Thank you.
Last time you came in to chat to me, it was July last year.
Yes.
And you just released your single 95, which
yes.
is on the album. So now you've got an album.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite a leap, isn't it, in terms of you as an artist and what you're saying?
Yeah, well, the plan was always to release an album and record that. That was kind of my big ambition. So the singles were just kind of to build up some anticipation for that, because no one really knew who I was. So... I had some great advice from Prue Ward from The Willows, who performs on the album, and she just kind of said to me, you know, you need to build up to these things, you can't just rush it all at once. So that was really useful. So I kind of took that on board, and which is why it's a lot later than I anticipated it to be, because there was kind of lots of what I wanted to do first, lots of gigging, lots of releasing of tracks, just to kind of get some awareness first.
But then now it is what you want, rather than rushing something out that you subsequently feel a bit embarrassed by or you don't want.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the album took longer to record than I anticipated, but in doing so, I'm, you know, I've got something that I'm really proud of, you know, the songs, the production, the people that played on it, you know, and the last 12 to 18 months touring, you know, gigging, meeting new people, playing with loads of amazing artists, making videos, you know, meeting artists to do artwork, all that kind of stuff. It makes being a musician really the kind of fun part, really.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm clunking about here because I am actually just looking at the arm. It looks lovely.
Thank you.
Must be very pleased with it.
I am, yes. It helps being married to a designer.
Oh, did she do?
Well, she did a lot of the inlay, and a friend of mine, Tom Jones, did the cover artwork, which was great because, once again, it's one of those things where I kind of had a concept in my mind and I kind of threw some ideas at him and then kind of let him go away with it, and he came back with something completely that I hadn't anticipated, but in doing so was something I loved and really captured what I wanted from the album. So it's kind of nice when that happens.
That's Ali, is it, your wife?
That was Tom that did the artwork, but at the same with Ali as well. I mean, she's done lots of my artwork before and she does a lot of my layout and design for me. So yeah, I mean, I used to be quite a control freak in the past, so I'm learning to let go a bit, and I think when you do that you can get really great results. The same with Stuart Harris when he did my artwork for We Are The Ones, the single, you know. His idea was completely not what I expected, but it was a beautiful piece of art and it really kind of captures the music. So I think it's great to give that freedom to people and then see what happens.
Yeah, it does look lovely. Well done, Ali and Tom. So when you're putting together an album, how does it work? Do you just think, well, I've got all these songs, I'll stick them on an album? Or do you think, I want this kind of mood, you know, that track goes there? I mean, how much thought goes into the actual putting it together?
Well, the next album will be very different from how this album was put together. So this being my first album, it was kind of like... I've got years and years of songs. So first I kind of went through
all the songs and demos I had from stuff I'd written for myself and for bands, and then I looked through old lyrics as well. So some of the songs on the album are songs that were lyrics from when I was a teenager that I thought, that's a good idea, maybe I can do something with that. So I kind of rewrote it. And some of them were fairly newish songs that I wrote specifically for the album, and some were kind of demos that I'd had knocking around. But I had so much stuff that in the end I had to... I literally put a survey up online and put it out on social media, and friends, family, fans just kind of responded with their three favourite songs. And
what a brilliant idea. So this is the People's Choice album.
Pretty much, yeah, and that kind of helps with the album title as well. I wanted it to be kind of a collaborative thing. And, you know, there are songs that I wouldn't have picked to put on the album that ended up on there.
That's interesting, isn't it, that your fans liked but they weren't necessarily one of your favourites?
Yeah, and the irony being that the one track that I wasn't going to include, Refugee, because it was a song that had been around for a while and maybe I was a bit tired of it, is probably the recording that I'm most happy with on the album. So there you go, that's what happens when you listen to people.
Oh, well, that's indeed, that's democracy in action. Well, I guess, as you say, you learnt a lot during this process, putting an album together, being in a studio for that length of time, mixing it. It must be fascinating.
Yes, definitely. And, you know, I know now how to kind of hopefully make it a slightly easier process for next time, although I have very different ideas for the next album, which I'm very keen to get on with. But, you know, it's an amazing process, and obviously working with James Coplaro, the producer, and the musicians on the album, you know, is an eye-opening experience, because a lot of those musicians are people that have played big volumes of people, and, you know, have been in the business for a long time, so they really know what they're doing. So for me, kind of fairly newish to doing this kind of stuff, I learnt a lot from them.
I suppose you're always learning as a musician, aren't you? I mean, the word journey is, you know, overused, but I suppose you are always evolving.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can always get better as a singer or guitarist, you can always meet more people, you can always hear new things. You know, every gig I play, a band I play with will always tell me something that I hadn't thought about before in terms of performance or where I should gig or who I should speak to or what I should be doing. So yeah, as you say, it's constantly evolving.
Well, we're going to listen to a couple of tracks off the album, though. The ones, there are some with swearing on, you naughty boy, but we're not playing those. We're listening to a track now called Dead End Disco Streets. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, so it's probably the track that's the most different from the rest on the album. It's kind of got a bit more of a poppy dance feel to it, but it's basically a song about kind of modern life and how it can get you down, but the flip side, being a musician and an artist, how music and dancing can kind of lift you out of those dark moments.
Talking about the NMG Awards off air there and the local music scene, what a great night that was as well, because you were nominated for, what was it, Best solo?
Male solo artist, yeah, it was an amazing night. I mean, as we were just talking about, I kind of always think that I know everyone in Cambridge, but you go to somewhere like that and there's just so many great acts from East Anglia, amazing bands, you know, bands like the CC Smugglers, who I saw live for the first time and were just I was blown away by.
Yeah, they were amazing, weren't they?
Such energy, and one of those acts that you can just imagine playing a really big festival and just the whole crowd moving, you know, shaking the earth for them. So, yeah, it was a brilliant night and really inspiring. And, you know, Tim's done a great job in making that such a big thing to celebrate the great music we have around here.
So what are the ambitions for you then? Now you had singles, you've had EPs, now this is an album. Sort of where to next then for you?
So I guess in the short term there may be a couple more releases from the album in terms of a couple more videos, just to eke that out as long as possible. But, you know, I'm really thinking about the next steps, which is I'd love to get over to Europe and place, you know, Germany, Austria, places like that. A lot of bands I've played with have said that it's amazing over in Europe. So I'd love to do that. And then the second album, which is been bubbling in my brain for about 6 months
you
now.
Can't wait to do the second album,
I know.
Can you?
Yeah, well, I guess any musicians like that, you know, once they've done one thing, they want to get on with the next. You know, I'm enjoying playing this album and, you know, I don't want to rush into the next thing, but it's very different from the last album because I have a fully formed idea of what track 1 to 16 will be. I know the titles, I know how it's going to flow because I've got a specific concept and idea in my head this time, so it's going to be a very different process.
That's brilliant. And the songwriting, that's still going strong?
Yeah, so obviously with this next album, I've kind of been chipping away at bits. You know, I've got always got books open with my notes in, and, you know, I've demoed a few tracks already. And I'm hoping that I can get some of the musicians that I've been working with to kind of come in and write some bits with me and perform on the album. I'd like to widen the scope on this one even more, so be even bigger, hopefully.
And is this what you do full time now, Gavin?
Not quite full time. So I still have a part time job as a fundraiser, but it's moving in that direction. It's obviously a tough and unstable industry, so I have to be very careful. But you know, being married to an artist as well, so we both have quite unstable industries. But you know, obviously being able to kind of do what you love most of the time is pretty great.
And how do you feel about all these? Because people will have said this to you, get on The Voice, get on The X Factor. How do you feel about those?
Well, yeah, I can understand why people say that. I mean, I obviously, like probably a lot of musicians, have very specific opinions about those programmes. I mean, lots of people enjoy them and watch them, so that, you know, that's for them. For me, I think if you're a musician and you really want to be a musician, then you just go and do music. You know, a meteoric rise to fame, in a lot of these cases, seems to last for a very short amount of time. And, you know, whilst when I was a kid, all I ever wanted was the fame and to play Wembley and massive stadiums, you know, now I just want to play music and write new music and meet new musicians. So, you know, I understand why people do it. But for me, you know, it's not really something I want to do. I think you lose out in a lot of ways. You know, I look at a lot of the bands that I love, bands like the Manics and Suede, and, you know, they spent a long time building fan bases up before they got any sort of notoriety. And I think because of that, they've got longevity, because, you know, neither of them are particularly in the charts much anymore, but they can still play really big venues because they've got a core fan base that they've built up. Whereas I think if you just kind of rush into fame, then it will disappear quite quickly, unless you're lucky and you're very talented and you're someone like Will Young.
And you're talking there about artistic integrity as well, really, aren't you? Because you cover particular subjects in your songs. You have freedom at the moment.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it would be like singing other people's songs. I mean, you know, I do covers, but they're often covers that I choose because I love them and I think I can do something with them. So, yeah, living in a world where you're kind of told what to sing and how to sing it, and, yeah, I mean, that's not for me. Obviously, some people like doing that. So, yeah, I can't imagine what that would be like, really.
So you said when you were little you imagined fame and fortune. You wanted to do this then since you were knee-high to a grasshopper?
Pretty young. Well, first I wanted to be a Ghostbuster. I think at some point I wanted to be in the army, and I'm sure at one point I probably wanted to play for England. So once I realised none of those were going to happen...
Oh, I wouldn't give up on the Ghostbuster.
Well, there's always a chance, isn't there? So, yeah, I mean... From a very young age, as soon as I heard Sergeant Pepper's at school.
Really? Was that it?
Yeah, well, we were, amazingly, we at junior school, we did a project on that album, which is pretty impressive for, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, yeah. At school. And I had a couple of friends who were already playing guitar, and one of them, like, sounded like Hendrix almost immediately, and the other one always reminded me of kind of Paul McCartney, the way he played guitar. And I think those two picking up a guitar kind of made me want to give it a go. So yeah, it was definitely those. From then I was just, you know, absorbed by music,
hooked. And in the near future you've got the album coming out on the 8th of April, so you've been doing lots of publicity for that, presumably.
Yeah, so yeah, there's obviously lots of PR going on, lots of radio shows, and I'm in the midst of a tour as well at the moment. So I've kind of off on a mini tour of the Midlands this weekend, and then I'll be back to Cambridge next Friday for the album launch, which I'm very excited by.
And then you get to do your second album. I can see you itching.
Yes. Yeah, finally.
Oh, well, lovely talking to you, Gavin. If people want to find out more, it's gavinchappellbates.com, and Chappell is with two P's and two L's, Chappell. And that's your married name, isn't it? I remember you telling me last time.
Yes, I was Bates before, so I've created one headache by, yes, making my name even longer. So, yeah, my email address is ridiculously long.
So is Ali Chappell Bates.
She is, yeah.
So. Yeah. Well, we will know her, won't we? It's a very unusual name. But gavinchappellbates.com is the website. Thank you ever so much. Lovely to see you again.
Likewise,
I'll do the traffic and travel, and then we'll play 95, which was that your last? No, have you had some singles since then?
It would have been the one before last.
The one before last, yeah. A great chat.
My guest this afternoon is Pat Duckworth, the award-winning author of Hot Women, Cool Solutions. And you specialise, Pat, in neuro-linguistic programming. I can't even say that this afternoon. Am I right?
You got it right. Yeah.
Just tell me a bit more about it. How does it work?
So neuro-linguistic programming was developed by two Americans back in the late 70s, early 80s. There was Richard Bandler, who was a mathematician. He still is, I shouldn't say was, the man's still alive. And John Grinder, who's a linguist. And if you think back to those times, it was when computers were first really being developed for popular use. And they were looking at the brain as a computer. That's the programming bit. The neuro bit, obviously relating to the brain, and linguistic, as in communication, but not just verbal communication, as in the way the body communicates as well, because we know a lot of communication is from the body and the way the face moves. So it brought together the brain, communication, and using the brain as a computer, and the fact that sometimes the programs just go wrong, they get a bit faulty, and you have to get in there and sort them out to help.
So are you basically saying you can sort of control, it's like controlling your own destiny, isn't it? You can, you know, you can think, as if you make yourself think a certain thing, is that, am I getting this right, or am I completely off track?
No, you're getting it right, because a lot of the time we're not even aware of what we're thinking that's influencing us, and a lot of the time they're not good things. So you can think, oh, I'm never going to pass this exam, I'm not good enough, I don't look as young as I used to. You know, you get these thoughts going through your head, and they affect the way that you relate to other people.
I wish you wouldn't look at me like that whenever you say that.
But these are the common messages that run in our brains that actually affect the way that we behave and the way we feel about what's going on. And if you can get in and start to alter the way you think about things, you alter the way you respond to the world.
So how does it work? What do you do?
So commonly people come to me for issues such as anxiety, lack of confidence. Slimming is often an issue. It could be giving up smoking. And everybody's different, so I have to find out through a whole series of questions how they're doing their problem. You know, a little bit about where it came from, and then how it happens day to day. And if it's eating, is it that they have an emotional connection to food? They eat in a different way between meals to how they'd eat during a meal. Or if it's confidence, are there certain things, certain situations that will trigger an emotion? And from that, I get to understand what I need to focus on. And perhaps there is a belief that's gone askew, or perhaps they've had an experience that's been particularly fearful, or, you know, has created an anxiety, and we have to go and deal with that situation. So it's lots and lots of techniques.
Well, on roughly in a session, what do you take a patient through then? Is it, do you go right back in time with them? Do you kind of look at their history and that sort of thing?
I do take some history, and, you know, if, let's say somebody came to me for a phobia, and so they've got a phobia about flying. That's
yes.
A fairly common phobia.
Yeah.
Now, it may be that there was a very specific incident that they were fine with flying, and then they went on a flight and it was particularly turbulent. And when they got off the plane, they felt terrible, and their brain stored it. You know, it wanted to learn from that situation, and it said, we're never going to do that again.
Right.
And even though they want to travel, what keeps going through their head is this message from their brain, you don't want to do that again, that was terrible. And there's a very specific technique that we do for debugging that memory, because the truth is they were fine before the flight, they were fine after the flight, they survived it, but their brain has got stuck in the message that something went wrong during the flight. And there are real techniques that we use just to kind of scrub that back out again.
Is it similar then to hypnotherapy?
Yes. Yeah, so a lot of what I do is NLP-based hypnotherapy. And when people come to me for hypnosis, they think I'm going to put them to sleep and all their problems will go, they'll wake up and they'll skip out the door. Often they do skip out the door, but it's because we've used a lot of techniques in between. So there's quite a lot of eyes open work. They're actually talking to me while we're doing the techniques.
So you're not hypnotising me now or anything, are you?
I might be, I'm just not fessing up to it. You might be surprised on the way home how different you feel.
So would you need a course of sessions, or is this resolved quite quickly, or how do you normally advise people?
It's surprising how quickly people start to feel better, and it really depends on the issue. I had somebody come to me very specifically, a lorry driver who suddenly couldn't drive over bridges. And I worked with him for about 10 minutes. He was so fearful when he talked about it, his hands would sweat just thinking about it. You know, his heart was going, he was feeling so uncomfortable. We did a piece of work and got to the end, and he said, I feel fine. And I said, okay, but I'm going to keep working with you. He said, honestly, I just want to go out and drive the lorry now.
Over a bridge.
So I said, well, let me just do a bit more work because I really want to consolidate what we've done. And before the session started, he said, I feel so bad about this, I would pay you £2,000 to get rid of it. Good and we got grief. To the end of the session and he said, how much do I owe you? And I said, do you remember the £2,000? And he went, yeah, but how much is it really? So I think I should have got the money first. But, you know, it depends what the issue is. Sometimes it can be a really quick fix. Other times there are underlying issues. I never know until somebody's sitting in the chair opposite me.
Is it similar to CBT? Because I've heard a lot of that, you know, for treating anxiety and exam nerves and things.
No, well, CBT is kind of based in the present and sorting things out for the future. So it deals with what thoughts you're experiencing at the moment and the behaviour that's a result of those thoughts.
Right.
With NLP and hypnotherapy, we're also dealing with what's gone in the past that has led to where you are now.
Right.
So sometimes you can deal with current thoughts and behaviour, but what's gone on in the past is still influencing and really you need to go back and sort it out. So there are some things from CBT that I might use in what I do, but it's not all that I do.
Okay, so you would use it perhaps in exam situations or driving tests or something like that?
Depends on the person, because CBT is a very kind of now and quite a cerebral thing because you're actually looking at your thoughts and you're noticing how you're thinking and changing how you're thinking. Whereas what I do, I'm kind of going more back into what's happening when you're not thinking.
Right, yes, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Now tell us a bit more about your book.
Yeah,
Hot Women Cool Solutions. Great title.
Thank you. Yeah, most women like that title. Men stop when they hear the hot women bit, but the women understand exactly where I'm going with it. So about 3 years ago, I was going to write a book and I thought, what is the book that Paul McKenna hasn't written yet?
Yeah.
He hasn't written about menopause and he's not going to because who's going to believe that one from a man? And I was having symptoms myself and I knew that a lot of the techniques that I was using was really helpful and I'd done a lot of research into how we could help ourselves really. Because one of the problems for women is that we get stressed about it, we don't get enough sleep. We don't really talk to each other about it either, which would be way more helpful. It's one of those subjects.
It's a bit taboo still, isn't it?
It is still a bit taboo. Mothers really don't talk to their daughters about it, you know, and we should be talking about it because the better state you go into it, the better you come out the other side. So my book, Hot Women Cool Solutions, brings together a lot of NLP techniques, a lot of positive psychology, really practical tips so that you can help yourself. And so you can talk about it if you want to seek help from a therapist or a practitioner. You can go along more informed about what you're experiencing. It's not just about the hot flushes, although if you experience serious and frequent hot flushes, you know just how debilitating that can be.
So can you teach yourself? Say if someone read your book, can you teach yourself these own practices?
Yeah, I teach them in the book. I tell you how to do it. And I've got some online resources on the website as well. I've actually got some recordings that people can just download so you can listen to it at night, you know, ones for better sleep and relaxation. You know, if you can relax, you get rid of a lot of that stress that leads to the symptoms.
Absolutely. My youngest daughter has had glandular fever for the past 3 months and she's got her complete clock back to front.
Yeah.
In that she can't sleep at night, but she can sleep all day.
Yeah.
And it's one of those really tough things because you don't really know the answer to it, you know, and she's tried, you know, taking her tablets at night or her medication at night and nothing seems to help.
Yeah.
So would perhaps, if she were to go online tonight and listen to your soothing voice, obviously, would that be an idea?
Yeah, it would. I have got a very soporific voice. Most of my clients say, well, I think I've listened to your recording. I hear the beginning and I hear the end. I'm not sure what happens in between. I say to them, I just keep talking. Ask my husband. He'll tell you. It doesn't matter if you fall asleep. I still keep talking.
I'm just in danger of putting me to sleep, I hope, and all our listeners. Can we talk vaguely about the cost of it? And, I mean, is it available on the NHS or not yet, as one of those things that haven't really?
Not yet. I'm really pleased that the institute that I trained with, the Quest Institute, is doing some validated research so that we can present to medical practitioners the proven efficacy of what we do. And once you can prove what you do and you have that bank of research, it's easier for the NHS to recommend you. So at the moment, CBT is really the only complementary therapy that the NHS will recommend. Mm. So when people come to see me or if they go to see another hypnotherapist, always look on the websites. Always ring up, ask the practitioner how much it is, whether it's per session, per hour, how many sessions they think you'll need. And if somebody's unwilling to talk about that with you, ring the next person.
Yeah.
Find somebody with qualifications. Find out if they're regulated by an institute as well. So do your research before you pick somebody. It's really important. And I offer people a free half an hour consultation, partly because I want them to feel comfortable.
Yes.
And partly because I want to be able to tell them whether I can work with them or not.
Have you got some good success stories?
Well, I've just told you the one about the lorry driver, but I had somebody who came to see me with a flight phobia, and she was going away. She was having one of those special birthdays with a naught on the end of it, and she wanted to be in a light aircraft. She loved elephants. They were going on a safari and she wanted to take pictures of the elephants. But she was so frightened she could hardly walk up the stairs to my therapy room. At the end of the session, and we'd been working for about an hour, and she said, I don't know whether the fear's gone. So I said, well, let's walk outside the room because it's an open staircase. And she walked out and she said, I feel fine. And then she burst into tears. And I said, what's the problem? And she said, I thought there'd be more voodoo to it. So there is no voodoo, okay? It's just that we use the techniques and they're very efficient. And then the next thing I got from her was a card with a picture of elephants that she'd taken out of the aeroplane.
Oh, what a nice when you get a happy ending,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Absolutely fabulous, yeah.
Pat, if anyone listening wants to get in touch with you, how do they get in touch with you?
So they can go to my website, Royston Hypnotherapy. I'm based just outside of Royston. And if they want to email me, it's pat@roystonhypnotherapy.co.uk.
That's absolutely great. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you, it's been fun. Thank you.
This afternoon I have with me Ian Tyse. Ian, of course, as you may know, is our legal expert. He's a retired solicitor, comes in once a month to Cambridge 105 to talk to us about various legal matters. And this month, and indeed next month, Ian, we're talking about discrimination, specifically discrimination between men and women.
Yeah, the Equality Act defines discrimination as either direct or indirect. And the difference is quite clear. A form of direct discrimination is where one group suffers and another group cannot suffer at all. So, for example, we're talking about gender discrimination today, and we'll be talking about issues that only affect men and that a woman could not possibly suffer from as well, and that would be direct discrimination. Indirect discrimination is where both genders can suffer, but overwhelmingly one gender suffers more than the other.
Okay, so for our discussion this afternoon, we're going to talk about the first of those two, i.e. direct discrimination, is that right?
Yeah.
So can you explain a bit more in detail about what direct discrimination actually sort of encompasses?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about, and I define for the purpose of this, what I call institutional discrimination as opposed to cultural discrimination. For institutional discrimination, I mean policies, practices, or laws which specifically are different for different genders. And we'll give some examples shortly. Well, cultural discrimination are things that you generally see in the media or whatever talking about as discrimination issues. Most of them are actually illegal if they happen, but they're things that people generally either choose to do or things that maybe as a result of culture or history or whatever mean that one gender is affected more than the other.
So maybe a good example of that would be equal pay. Would that be fair? Is that a gender discrimination based on culture?
I believe so, because it's illegal to pay men and women a different amount for the same job. And anybody who suffers from discrimination or believes they do can take a case to an employment tribunal. And therefore, that becomes cultural. That is, people choose different occupations, different careers to work full-time rather than part-time. And these things result in differential pay, but it's not discrimination. What I'm talking about here are issues or policies or practices where the government or local authorities have set up a specific law or policy which directly or indirectly discriminates on the basis of gender only.
Okay, so we're talking about basic differences between men and women here. So is it, and the I guess the implication is that men don't have the same level of discrimination rights as women. Is that a fair statement?
I think it's fair to say that the generally accepted view is that women suffer more than men. But in fact, when it comes to institutional discrimination, looking at the laws, which we'll do, you'll find, I think you'll agree with me, that men suffer more than women from institutional discrimination.
Okay, well, I'm going to challenge you on that. We'll see.
Of course, I hope you do.
Okay, so men versus women, discrimination of one versus the other. I guess the starting point for all of this probably is in the home, as parents, and how the law supports one side of the gender equation compared to the other. So could we talk a little bit about that?
We can talk about pregnancy, if you like, which is where the start of these sort of direct discrimination issues occurs. So, for example, when a woman gets pregnant, then she's allowed to get maternity grants and maternity leave at the 26th week of
pregnancy. But surely that's all very justified, isn't it? Because she's in a situation where she needs to have that sort of help and time off work and so on. So what does the law say with regard to pregnancy and parenthood and the differences between men and women there? You know, you've mentioned about the legal requirement to give women time off work quite naturally to have a baby and so on. What does the law say about all that?
Okay, a woman can have 12 months maternity leave. A man only gets 2 weeks paternity leave. The woman can transfer the last 3 months of the 12 months, which is unpaid, to the father if she chooses. And this is an overwhelming fact that flows through all of these issues, that the woman has the power to choose. The payment for maternity leave is paid at 90% of the salary, or a maximum of £130 or thereabouts. And overwhelmingly, it wouldn't be of much interest to men. Paternity leave is not very highly taken up because the men generally working full-time, women generally are more likely to work part-time. So there's a big drop in pay for a man, or bigger drop in pay for men.
I mean, it's a few years now since my children were born, and I think the law has changed quite substantially, arguably in favour of men, actually, during that period, because I know when my kids were born, you couldn't legally have paternal leave from work. Now you can. So that sounds to me as though actually men have been getting a better deal.
You could argue that. Men's increase in paternity leave has gone from 0 to 2 weeks, but women's has gone from, I think, 6 weeks to 12 months. So you could easily argue that women have benefited much more. Also, it's now paid for 9 months of those 12 months. The women's jobs have to be kept open for them until they decide whether they want to return to work. So all of these factors are very much in favour of women. You're also not allowed to fire a woman because she's pregnant, and that would be grounds for unfair dismissal.
Okay, so we accept that there is a difference there. Is it actually reasonable to expect that we could level the scales up on something like that? You know, does the man reasonably need to have the same degree of relief, for want of a better phrase, that the woman has in a case of pregnancy? They need that?
You could argue that it should be up to the parents to choose how they divide up the parental leave, and as happens in Scandinavia, where the parents can divide it up amongst themselves rather than the government saying that 9 months must go to the woman and 3 to the man. It would be much fairer if that was between the parents to decide, and if they want to take it simultaneously so that they can look after the child when it's first born, then that would be for them to decide. And I think that would be a fairer application for the system rather than the unfair balance as it is at the moment.
What about parental responsibilities after the child's been born?
Okay, well, this is a clear case of direct gender discrimination, because unmarried parents do not have equal rights. Married parents do. So married mothers, married fathers have equal rights regard to their child from birth. Unmarried parents don't. And this is all summed up in the phrase defined in the Children Act as parental responsibility. That's all the rights, duties, responsibilities associated with having a child. An unmarried mother gets these automatically on birth. An unmarried father can only get them in one of four ways, three of which require the consent of the mother. That is, he can marry her, which obviously requires her consent. And that's either before or after the baby's born. He would then acquire parental responsibility. He can sign a parental responsibility agreement with her, and again, requires her consent. He can go on the birth certificate, and to do that also requires the mother's consent, because within 6 weeks of birth, the mother has the right to register the birth on her own if it's unmarried, and the unmarried father doesn't have that right. However, if he jointly registers with the mother and his name is on the birth certificate, he then acquires parental responsibility. But clearly, that can only be done with the consent of the mother.
And just run through what are the differences in parental responsibility for us again there, Ian, would you?
Yeah, and these encompass everything that is about making decisions which should be in the best interests of the child. So, for example, if for whatever reason you wanted to have a circumcision, only the mother would need to decide that. And through religious reasons, circumcisions are usually performed on boys only. It's been illegal to circumcision on girls since about 1985 in this country, but not for boys. Nevertheless, it happens within the first 10 days of birth for most religions. And since the mother won't necessarily have registered the birth before that time, the father has no parental responsibility and therefore no right to stop a circumcision. And clearly, amongst many other, unlike many other aspects, such as deciding the religion of a child or their name, once you've been circumcised, you can't be uncircumcised. And therefore, this is a crucial thing that is done at the consent only of the mother. But there are other aspects of this unilateral power that could be used, and obviously name. You know, you on the birth certificate, you name the child, and unless the father is present, then there'll be a blank alongside where the father's name is, and so the child won't necessarily know who his father is. The mother has a legal opportunity to do this on her own if she's unmarried. Unmarried fathers cannot do this without the mother's consent.
Has the law changed very much in regard to parental responsibility over the years? Because lots of these things, I guess, are things that we've grown up with and they've been in existence for a very long time. And I guess what I'm saying is there a strong demand by men to have the law changed to be equal in those respects? Because important as they are, we get by without having to change the law. We get by with things being as they are quite happily, I guess, for the most part. Or is that not true? I mean, do you get many men coming in, or did you get many men coming in to see you when you were a practicing solicitor to try and address these sorts of issues?
Yes, very much. It's the fundamental thing that stops men being or playing a full role in the child's life, if the mother chooses to use it, and it gives her the power to choose whether or not the father's involved in the child's life.
But one would assume that the only sort of times where this is going to become an issue is where the relationship between the man and the woman perhaps is not as good as it might be.
Yeah, and after separation is the time when I tend to see people complaining about this, because while you're still with the woman, as you say, none of these things matters because you're going to be having...
It's harmonious, isn't it?
Yeah, in the normal situation. And while you've both got equal access to the child and you're having a good relationship, it's not an issue. But we have hundreds of thousands of relationship breakdowns in this country every year, and there are a number of cases which end up in court.
What's your feeling? Is the law likely to change? Is there a body of opinion that's pushing legislation to be amended to level things up, or will the status quo remain?
Unfortunately, this situation has been around for 40 years. I don't see it changing overnight. While some of the equality units in theory look at children's rights, whenever this issue is looked at, which it's looked at maybe once every 10 years, they conclude that there's nothing wrong with the system and that they propose no change. And specifically, they oppose the idea of a default presumption of 50-50 on contact time, shared residence, if you like, after separation.
Ian, thanks ever so much for coming in. Incredibly interesting topic there. Next month, I think you're coming in to talk about discrimination between men and women again, but I think this time around we're actually going to be talking about indirect as opposed to direct discrimination. Is that right?
That's right, yes, and okay. I'll define what I mean then.
Great stuff. Look forward to seeing you back in again next month.
Thank you very much.